up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, maybe? Hopeful, wishful thinking, hopefully?
You gotta say that with the right tone. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls.
Yes, but that sounds so confident when I don't think that there's a lot of boys and girls paying attention to an economic. I mean, if you're... go ahead.
How many ladies and gentlemen do we actually have?
With this bunch, I think they're all ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, okay. I thought it was just people out there.
Right. It's a good question. Are people listening, or should we include the dogs that are sitting with the family and the cats as well? Or they may have as much interest in this program as the boys and girls. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and this is why we are doubtful that children are listening to the program, though I think it'd be awesome if they did. This is Jake McClure speaking to you right now, and on the line with me I have...
Jeff McClure.
Together we are both the co-hosts of this radio program / podcast, and also the principals at an SEC registered investment advisory firm with the same name.
Whoa, how did that happen?
It's purely coincidental. We have to tell you about that because the firm that we are members of, that we represent usually when we're giving investment advice, doesn't give investment advice on the radio, because investment advice is something you have to actually know the person that you're talking to. And while I believe I know a lot of you, there are a lot more of you that we don't know. I'm constantly surprised that you would choose to use your Saturday morning listening to two bald guys talk about the nerdy science of economics and whether or not dollars are an export. So we are, the firm is an SEC registered investment advisor, and just because it's registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission doesn't mean that they give us any kind of a thumbs up or a thumbs down. If they gave us a thumbs down, we probably wouldn't be a firm. If they gave us a thumbs up, then they wouldn't be the SEC. How's that?
You got it. Go stand the SEC.
You want to do the next, the deeming?
We're supposed to talk about the fact that we don't pay for the radio show.
Oh, well, I was going to have you do the deem one. I can do the radio program one.
Deem then. The information we present, the educational information we present on this radio program is obtained from sources, or has been obtained from sources we deem reliable. However, we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
Yep, you definitely say warranty. You had said that I should be saying warrant. You definitely say warranty.
Well, actually, we make no warranty. You don't make warrants. You warrant, but you don't make warrants. You make no warranty or guarantee.
Well, this doesn't even warrant our conversation, I would say.
Now you need to tell them about paying for the radio show.
Yes. We do not pay for this radio show, this radio program, nor do they pay us. In fact, there is no quid pro quo, Senator. We do, however, pay advertisements on KTEM. We advertise for the radio program, which makes probably as much sense to you as it does to us. We do this very consciously as a way of communicating with our existing clients, as well as educating a populace which is horribly lacking in sources of good information on economics and how to learn this stuff without having to go through a lot of years of college without really retaining any of the first parts of the year, because it's all debunked. Just as a side note, that is how economics is taught today. This is not a joke. This is not a conspiracy theory. If you talk to economics professors about this, you will get this answer as well. Macroeconomics 101 and microeconomics 101 are made of about 90% debunked economic myths that you have to understand the math for in order to proceed to the non-debunked theories of economics.
The non-debunked myths.
Yeah, so they still teach it as fact, which is It is a great hazing ritual for all econ majors. They have to go through, it's kind of like psychology where they teach you Freud first. They still teach Freud, and at least now they don't teach it as fact. They still do teach the original econ classes as fact, and then you have to get to a higher level before they say, oh yeah, forget all that stuff. Just remember the math.
I'll never forget having to learn to calculate the capital market line, which doesn't work.
Well, it works for what it's for. You can calculate a line.
It doesn't work in the real world.
Yeah, it's a good way of measuring risk, but nothing falls on that line. It'd be like, I don't know. There's no really good analogy. It's like saying you're safe if you stand in this circle, but nothing ever enters the circle.
Well, it's kind of like if you were to calculate the distance between the start of the Mississippi River.
Right, in a straight line.
And the mouth of the Mississippi River and say that's how long the Mississippi River is, because it's obviously a straight line and I've calculated it. The problem is, of course, Mississippi River is actually over 50% longer than that because it zigzags around.
I think the word is meander. And I'm only using that word because we use Dean and people don't get to say meander very often.
Meander is another good word. Well, I guess we better get on to the business at hand, which is the economics and stock market and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The stock market, yes, it's doing wonderful things at the end of this year. And in anticipation of 2021, probably 2022, the S&P 500 stock index, which by the way, constitutes just under $30 trillion in market capitalization. That's a lot of money. Even by the government standards, that's a lot of money. Continued to roll forward in the week, and it went to 3699.12, almost 3700. That's a number you can remember. Up about 1.67% for the week. It's up 14.3% year to date. Now, still, the S&P 500 is being driven by the top 10 companies. They still have the majority of the rise in the market this year. And I read that the median stock in the S&P 500 is down 3.89% for the year. However, the good news is...
Wait a minute. We got to define a statistical term. Most people listening to this know that term, but it's probably been a long time since they used it. Median means right in the middle. So if you have...
Right.
It's not the average. It's right in the middle. So there you go.
250, if you look at the gains in the S&P 500 stock by stock, there's 250 stocks roughly that had a lower gain than a negative 3.89%, and there's 250 stocks that had a better gain than negative 3.89%, but it's in the middle of the stock. So there's a lot of stocks that are still down for the year, a lot of stocks. Why look to balance out the S&P 500, which is mainly large cap growth at this point, I have a tendency to look at the CRSP Mid Cap Value Index, which is stocks.
It's what stocks?
Mid-sized stocks.
And
because the small companies generally aren't in the S&P 500.
Right.
And it is value rather than growth, which means that the stocks are priced based on their underlying intrinsic value rather than on how much they're expected to grow their earnings over the next several years. It rose 1.84% for the week. Now, why is that important? It rose more than the S&P 500, which means that the smaller side of the S&P 500, which is the mid-cap stocks, and the value side, which is the stocks that are priced according to their intrinsic value, actually are rising faster than the broad market for the first time, not this week for the first time, but in the last month, since the election, actually, they've been rising faster than the rest of the market. And that's good. It finally, because the mid-cap value index that I just quoted is finally into positive territory for the year, which is yay, that's good. Means that the market is becoming more evenly balanced. And the way we get out of a market that's way overpriced on the large cap growth side is to have a market crash. So the possibility exists that we can correct without having a market crash this time around. It is really different this time because, at least in my experience, 30, let's see, I started in 1982. Let me get my shoes off so I can count.
if that's more than 20, more than 30, more, almost 40.
Almost 40 years of watching this stuff, because I watched it before I got in.
I ran out of fingers and toes.
We've never had a pandemic cause a market decline or market rise. So
I was just noticing this. Next month will be my anniversary for being in the investment world business. It'll be 30 years. So you're at 38 and I'll be at 30. Combined, we have 68 years, which is a really bad way of doing math, just as a side note, because we shouldn't combine our experience when our experience was relatively the same during the time period.
Right. Anyway, the market is doing what's called a rotation, which means that the value stocks are finally beginning to come up to speed. They're nowhere near as far along as the S&P 500 as a whole. It's up 14.3% year to date, whereas the value, the mid-cap value stocks, which is the lower half of the S&P 500, our lower portion of the S&P 500 are only at a break-even point right now, maybe just over the break-even point. So, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average got through the 30,000 level again on Thursday, but this time it managed to stay up through Friday. The last two times it's actually gotten through 30,000 twice now before this, and both times it got up there and promptly fell back. And there's a reason for that. When the Dow Jones Industrial Average hits a round number, it almost always falls back because people are saying, I'm going to hold on to these stocks until the Dow hits 10,000 or 20,000 or 30,000, then I'm going to sell. So every time it hits a big round number, there's a bunch of selling goes on, generally by amateur investors, and that pulls it back down again. But it stayed up Thursday. It got there Thursday and stayed up there Friday, so that's a good sign that things are stable or more stable.
Right. Hold on. I just muted you out by talking on top of you. Sorry. Say that again.
The 10-year Treasury yield is the big one this week, if you're a geek and you follow such things. The 10-year Treasury yield rose to 0.972%. Now, that probably sounds extremely geeky, but it's been down to 0.5%. It's been rocking around to 0.7, 0.7, 0.6 for a long time. The fact that it's up near 1% is an amazing thing. Matter of fact, it rose 15. The yield rose 15% in this time period in the week. So it is we're really seeing things look like the markets in general are saying we're going to see a recovery in demand, we're going to see a recovery in earnings, we're going to see things do a lot better in the near future. Now, don't get too excited. It doesn't mean that you can run down to the bank and buy a CD for some reasonable rate of return, because the short-term treasuries in the secondary market are yielding 0.075%. That's 0.0751%, which is next to nothing. So short term, and in CDs, you're still not going to get very much. You're going to get not even keep up with inflation, but at least things are beginning to go in the right direction.
Right. Can I hit some labor notes, or you want to finish up? You have more on market?
Well, the only thing I have is West Texas Intermediate crude oil is up to $46.09. Now, that
you don't have to get crude on the air. You really don't have to get crude. I didn't ask for a crude conversation.
It is crude. It's 42 barrel bucket of crude, stinky stuff.
42 gallon barrel, is that what you mean?
Yeah, 42 gallon barrel.
You said a 42 barrel bucket, which
bucket barrel.
Yeah. But just as a side note, there's 42 gallons in a barrel of oil, and we make jokes about that regularly because those of you that are really nerds will understand the reference to the number 42. If not, you should look it up in Google to tell how nerdly we really, really are.
The key there is that in the last month, West Texas Intermediate crude, which is the marker we use in the United States, the benchmark for price of oil, is up almost 23% in the last month. Again, that is not because there's a shortage of oil production in the world or in the United States. It's because demand is moving up.
Right.
Right now, demand is coming out of China, but there's anticipation of demand rising in the United States as airlines begin to fly again. The vaccine is doing a lot of this.
Yeah, the preparation for when we go back to traveling. Then the big question is, how much more are we going to travel? Are we going to travel as much as we used to? I have an easy answer to that, by the way.
What's your answer?
The commute stuff, commuting back and forth, probably we won't do as much as we did. But the other kind of travel, we're going to do more of it for a while. Because I don't know about you, but every single person I've spoken to for the past 3 months has talked about how they want to get back to normal so they can go and do the things that they put off doing while they were not doing things.
It's the cattail theory.
Yes. And I will explain that. This is one of my leading economic theories of all time. The more restraint that is put on a cycle, the more violent the action at the end when the restraint is pulled free. And that sounds like a very complicated thing. How do you get cattail theory out of this? If you've ever known a cat, when you're sitting next to a cat, if it's sitting comfortably next to you, but maybe slightly, just a little bit uncomfortable, its tail, just the tip of it, starts to flick back and forth, just little flicks. Now, out of the goodness of your heart or out of the need for to remove this annoyance of a cattail flicking next to you, you say, I know what to do. I will remove all the instability of this situation. I'm going to grab the cat's tail and hold it still gently. I'm not going to grab it hard. Just going to gently hold on to the end of the tail for a little bit. What do you think will happen when I let go? My cattail theory for economics is that when an outside influence, governmental control, pandemic control, changes a normal supply and demand business cycle, when the change is removed, you get a very violent movement. Violent, not necessarily a bad violent movement, but a violent movement. When the pandemic is no longer restraining us from doing what we wish to do, I think a lot of people are going to take a lot of time to do things that they didn't do before. And that there are some threats on that subject. You know, threats, what are the threats? So this is, we're talking about oil demand. How do we get threats out of that? Well, the threat is that there's a lot of cash that's been built up. And if people suddenly feel the need to spend all that cash, we're going to get some inflation. So hopefully we've got some restrained movement forward. If you let go of the cat's tail slowly enough, maybe it will forget that you were holding on to it. Usually doesn't work that way. Go ahead.
Speaking of inflation, there was another little bump that's a little too geeky for most people to really get their minds around, but it's important. The FRED, the St. Louis Federal Reserve website, announced this week that the break-even inflation rate for 5 years rose to 1.83%, which is really a geeky thing.
That's very geeky. Break-even inflation, what does that even mean?
That means, according to the prices people are paying in the bond market for treasuries that are inflation-adjusted, TIPS.
Treasury and inflation-protected securities, TIPS.
You'd have to, they're in effect forecasting the big money, billions of dollars, is forecasting what inflation will be over the next 5 years. And of course, that forecast suggests that if you don't get at least 1.89% on your money that you've got in a safe position, you're going to lose money over the next 5 years. In other words, any interest rate below 1.89% is a negative interest rate.
Yeah, inflation is moving up. That's not a guesswork. We're seeing those numbers already. It's something we've talked about in the past. But let's kind of, why don't we hit that? What is inflation? What does that even mean? People talk about inflation. A lot of times people don't talk about what it means. What's inflation? What would you say?
Inflation is basically the devaluation of the dollar in common usage. In other words, we talk about the CPI. There's actually several different ways of measuring inflation. Consumer price index is the most popular, not necessarily the most accurate, but basically how many dollars does it take to live and buy things in your life, which actually there's a different index that covers that a little better. consumer, what's the consumer expenditures? Yeah.
Yeah. Consumer expenditures survey. Yeah.
And it boils down to inflation occurs when it takes more dollars to buy the same thing.
So where does that come from? And I'll give you my side of that, if you don't mind, just real quick. If more money is paid for something than the value was represented from before. So let me give you an example. If you decide to pay your employees more when they haven't increased their productivity, they haven't gotten better at what they're doing, they're still producing exactly the same amount of things, and you decide to pay them more for the things that they're making. That's one side. If that's happening across the entire system as kind of a cultural movement, and that's what all of these movements are. If people say, hey, they deserve to get paid a little bit more, I know they've been working hard, I know they haven't really improved, but I'm going to give them a little extra money. And that's the way it goes across the board. We get inflation. In the 1970s, it was mostly union driven to get that inflation. We had a lot of inflation in the 1970s. And the reason was because we didn't have any competition on the planet. We had we were the only nation, only industrialized nation on the planet that wasn't bombed into oblivion and rebuilding. We were helping other nations rebuild. And so we were the dominant manufacturer of just about every industrial piece of equipment. Doesn't matter if you're talking about bulldozers, airplanes, automobiles, washing machines, any kind of industrial manufacturing, we were dominant in. And that meant we didn't have any competition except ourselves. So we were giving ourselves raises every year based on how long we've been working there. And that was written into union contracts. It was written into the ethos of who we were. Hey, I've been here for 15 years. I deserve a raise. We still have that thought in our culture. When you give people a raise, regardless of production, our productivity rate, by the way, during that time period was dropping, and people were getting raises, and they were built into the contracts. So you got a raise after you've been there a certain number of years, regardless of, and you just didn't do anything wrong. And that led to an attitude of, hey, buy it now, because if you wait, the price is going to be higher. And the buy it now attitude makes the price go higher, because if everybody's buying it now, then you can afford to raise the price on it. So you had this systemic wave of opinion that led to inflation. We have a lot of cash sitting out there right now. We've got some questions on that. John, who is our most faithful questioner. Thank you, John. Again, you are in many ways a lifesaver. You give us a lot of questions, and we'll get to them. One of his questions is on this subject. Where do businesses park all this trillions of dollars of cash that, you know, you see it in the headlines, businesses sitting on record quantity of cash? How is that measured? Where his question is, where do they park it? Where do you park trillions of dollars? Do you have an answer for him?
Yeah, you park it with people who can hold trillions of dollars. For example, Goldman Sachs, Pershing, Bank of New York, Bank of New York, not Pershing.
J.P. Morgan Chase, yeah.
What happens is, in some cases, they have internal money management divisions in places like Microsoft, where they have a lot of cash. And they have cash management accounts, they're called. They're not FDIC insured, and they're not necessarily money market funds. Basically, the cash management division or the cash management managers in the big investment banks are told by a corporation, here is a bunch of excess money that we have, and some of it we'll need in 30 days, some of it we'll need in 60 days, some of it we'll need in 90 days, some of it we can leave parked for 2 years because we have a plan for what we're going to do with it. So the managers then invest that money in various securities.
Generally very, very short maturity securities, things that are about to mature pretty soon.
Well, it's if it's short-term money. If it's two-year money, they invest it in something that will be a little longer. Sometimes they put it in stocks and bonds as well.
Mm-hmm.
They manage the money to get the highest return they can for that time period. Yeah. Right. Normally, it's a fairly easy thing to do when interest rates are up. Right now, It's a real drill to figure out what to do with it, because there's a lot of excess money rolling around out there in savings positions. And as a result, interest rates are nearly zero in out about 2 years. So I would imagine those money management people are pulling their hair out if they have any.
Right. And this is an interesting kind of scenario here. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Whoa, that's ancient history. That was 2018. What am I talking about here? Well, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that cut the corporate tax rates and cut the personal income tax rates temporarily. The corporate tax cuts were permanent. The personal rates are temporary. What did that do? What's going on? So one of the things that the thought was that would raise the revenue for the United States government is that there were a lot of companies that had money sitting overseas that they had earned overseas and simply would not bring back to their headquarters, wouldn't bring back to the United States because the corporate tax rate was so high that they would just leave it in Ireland or in Spain or in Portugal or in Italy or wherever it was, rather than bring it back to the United States, which was preventing internal reinvestment. So Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, they said, all right, well, we'll do this, and that will put a flat tax on the cash that they're holding overseas as well. So they'll want to bring it back regardless. So that went forward, and we saw a surprisingly low number of money, low amount of money coming back from overseas during 2018 and 2019. What was going on with that? Well, it's because of cash management programs. That cash had been sitting there long enough that it wasn't cash anymore. It had been invested in things. So the tax didn't get applied to these things that it was invested in. When we talk about where did all this extra cash come from during the pandemic, some of it came from that. So we had a slight burst, a slight bump up and tax revenue on the corporate side early in the year, as a lot of that money was pulled back years after the Tax Cut and Jobs Act to the United States as emergency money. But at the same time that they were offsetting that in a lot of cases with losses. So the revenue was temporary as the money came back to the corporation. So where the money is a really good question. And what is money is even maybe a better one, in that a lot of times when people talk about how much cash a corporation is holding, it's not really cash. It's invested in something else temporarily. So that's a great question. Where is all this cash? I mean, if you took all the trillions of dollars that people claim is in corporate cash positions, you'd have a lot more cash in the market than we see. We see a lot of cash in the market, but not enough to represent all of that. It's because it's partially invested, hopefully in shorter term stuff, but some of it's in stocks and bonds. And some companies have made some real mistakes in that area.
One of the things that it's in many cases, is short term loans or loans, car loans and things like that through banks. They actually securitize those loans now. They're fairly secure. They're fairly stable. They're fairly predictable. But the thing about corporations is they have some really secure money that's actually parked in bank accounts. They have some money that's parked in treasuries that's short term. But when they say they have a lot of cash, it simply means it's liquid. It could be in Microsoft stock, for example, or someplace it's some stock that's paying a high dividend because they do want some return on the money. They take some risks with that money.
We got another question from him as well, and it kind of flows along the same channel of money supply, of what's going on with this.
Probably ought to give out our email addresses.
Let's do that.
You can email us and ask us questions or make comments at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's TangoPapaWhiskeyCharlie.com.
Or the personal wealth coach. Right.
You can actually send it to like Jake@thepersonalwealthcoach.com if you just want to use up a lot of letters.
Yeah, you can do that if you wish. But it'll make your tweets shorter on the other areas. Please don't tweet. Just friends don't let friends tweet. It's just
That's
a
right.
thing.
Right.
Okay. So this is the next question. There's an article headline. John generally asks us a question with a picture of where he's getting the question. He says something that he's read, and he goes, "What is this? What is this?" So there's a headline, and I'm assuming it's the Wall Street Journal because that's often what he sends a picture of. And the headline is, "Many firms resume matches to 401k retirement plans. Okay. And then his question is, as companies cut back on matches and people tap their accounts to survive during COVID, what's the long-term impact in terms of funding a successful retirement? That is a fantastic question. And it's one that is amongst the professional circuits of fiduciaries and the academic area of economic research, it is one of the biggest questions out there. Of a lot of the companies came up with extra cash to pad their bank accounts just in case so that they could keep making payroll. By cutting back on the extra things like putting a match into a retirement account. Just as a side note, when the U.S. government gets shut down occasionally because they can't agree on a budget, one of the superpowers of the Treasury is to somehow come up with extra money. One of the ways they do that is by cutting back on the matching that goes into the TSP and into the G fund. So they do reports on that. You can actually look at the Treasury website and see Mnuchin's report to Congress on the effectiveness of turning off the matching in the G fund and back on after the last government shutdown. So it makes sense that a 401k, that a corporation that's funding a 401k that doesn't know what its profits are going to be, suddenly there's a massive hit. We might not be profitable this year. We might have to lay people off. We'd rather stop matching than lay people off. They have a little bit of leeway if their 401k was written correctly to say in the event that they're in dire straits, they can turn off the match. And that means that temporarily or permanently, money going into the 401k program doesn't get matched. At the same time, the CARES Act gave the ability for people to take withdrawals from their IRAs and from their 401ks penalty-free based on COVID situations, if they've been laid off, if they had a family member that had COVID, or if they had COVID. What does that mean for the long-term plan for these people's retirement? And to answer that question, now that we've laid out the foundation of what the question really is about, let's take a step back. The number one priority always in preparing a long-term plan for retirement is short-term. You need to have cash on hand to cover emergencies. If people did not have that portion of their retirement plan in place, a retirement plan meaning you have enough money in the bank that you don't have to cut into your retirement assets for the future, that puts a big, nasty cloud over everything into the future. What we're seeing, though, is a great deal of savings being built up on the side. 401ks, I know often they're called retirement savings plans. They're not technically savings unless they're in a money market account. They are investments. They are not made to preserve your assets, but rather to hopefully grow them. If they're in a cash position, then that's a preservation mode. That's cash. That's savings. Just to get that impression deeper, savings is the root of that is the same for safe. And if you put money in investment, even if it's a really, really good investment, there are risks that go along with it. So that's by definition not savings. All right. So what are the long-term impacts for retirement on this? It's not just on matching and on people tapping their retirement plans, but also on not putting lots of money in their retirement plans this year, as well as the payroll tax cut that the president signed through executive order, cutting back on the amount of money going into Social Security, and massive numbers of people getting laid off, representing a lot more money that was being paid into Social Security through their payroll taxes when they had a job. What I can say in a very vague sense is it's not a good long-term impact. It's not catastrophic, but it's certainly not a good thing, and something that is going to require a lot of personal vigilance on the part of people that do tap their 401ks or their IRAs for money right now. They need to really put a priority on getting that stuff paid back to themselves. Do you think I answered that well?
I think you did. The other thing is, for instance, in the last, well, since the election, the market has risen a bunch, which is a technical term for
Over 10% is a bunch, right.
So let's just say that just before the election, you took a lot of money out of, you took a big chunk of money out of your 401k to cover, to buy a car or to make a down payment on a house or whatever. And you said, I'll put that back in a month because now sell my other house and I'll put the money back in. The cost on that loan that you borrowed from your 401k isn't the interest rate that you paid. It's the 10% that you lost in the month that it was out of the market. And that 10%, if you annualize it, that's 120% interest rate, which is no fun at all.
No.
Which you, a lot of money because your money was not in your 401k.
And a lot of cases, people's 401ks were still down when they tapped them. So they were up before, down when they got the money out, and then up when they put the money back in, which is the true definition of what most people do in investing, which is sell low and buy high.
And the issue is that a long-term retirement account, like a 401k or an IRA, is a long-term retirement account. Now, Congress has continued to put little ways of getting the money out to make a down payment on a home, to pay for college educations, and they gradually make loans to do various things. But the important thing is to remember that this is a long-term retirement account, not a put-and-take piggy bank.
What's a put-and-take?
Put and take, take, piggy bank. And if you use it for short-term needs, you're going to pay for it in retirement. And you may pay thousands of, I mean, that sounds ridiculous, but you may pay thousands of dollars for every $100 that you take out of your retirement account temporarily in a loan or anything else. The other thing about loaning, borrowing money from your 401k, particularly in an economic downturn, I know that sometimes you think that's the only option. If you get laid off with the money out of your 401k, you have a very limited time. I think it's 60 days. I think it's 60 days to get it back into the 401k, or you pay full taxes plus the 10% penalty.
Right.
And that's no fun at all. You're stuck.
Yeah. One of the things, this is, we got to play some commercials, but when we come back, we want to talk a little bit about 401k loans. We also, there's another question waiting for us out there. If you'd like to ask us a question while we're off on break, or while we're not, we're taking questions through email, and the email addresses that we're taking questions through are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's a Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or the Personal Wealth Coach. let's kind of approach it. Let's kind of look at it from multiple directions. Number one, when you put money into your 401k, you don't have to pay taxes on it if it's going into the traditional side. So the money goes in there. You haven't paid taxes on it. That's great. You've had it removed from your paycheck without having to pay taxes on it yet. You'll have to pay them when you pull the money out sometime in the future. Well, you've got this expense you need. So you get the money out. You get a loan. You have a little interest rate to pay it on. And now you spend it on college. Well, that's great. Okay, you've got this done. And the interest rate is generally a lot lower than you could get at a bank or somewhere else because it's collateralized with your money in your 401k. Well, you've got a 60-day period if you get laid off to get that money back in there. Or there's penalties and there's taxes on top of everything. Okay, so let's just assume for temporary purposes, you're not laid off. It's a pretty good assumption. Most people don't get laid off every day. You still have to pay that money back over time. Otherwise, the interest on the loan keeps growing and it's not good. Okay, so you start paying it back. Well, what are you paying it back with now? You're paying it back with money that you've already paid taxes on. It's not coming out of your paycheck pre-tax anymore. Now you pay taxes on the money and you put it back in there. And you could say, well, I was going to spend that money on college anyway. But now you've paid the taxes on it. It's in your 401k. But when you pull that money out again, you're going to pay taxes on it again. Oh, you can think about that for just a second. It's not pre-tax money anymore. If you put it back in after the loan, you pay taxes on it. So there's ways of looking at this mathematically where it can be a break even, where you would have paid taxes on the money you spent on college anyway. You would have paid taxes on the money you were spending on your house anyway. But there's something fundamentally wrong in my mind on paying back a loan with after-tax money. If you got the money out of your 401k, that's pre-tax money that you used. When you put the money back in to pay that loan off, you're absolutely correct. You didn't have to pay taxes when you took the loan out, but you'll have to pay taxes on the money that you put back in to pay the loan off after the fact. And to me, that's just it's a difficult thing in my mind to bear. The fact that now if you lose your job, you got to get that money back in there. And there are times when the 401ks change from one custodian to another or one record keeper to another. If your trustee is in flux at work, all those things can cause complications in paying back the loans. And this is supposed to be long-term retirement money. It is not the best place to get money. It really is not. And in most cases, if you're planning on putting somebody to college, starting a different kind of program for that early on is a lot better route. We often recommend 529 plans. Of course, they have to fit the person. This isn't something we just broadly say everybody needs one. But if you're using a 529 plan to pay for college, you don't have to pay taxes on any of the growth in there. And that's a fantastic method for paying for college. Using a 401k means that you're paying taxes on all of it to pay for college. So there's other better vehicles for most of the things that you can do with a loan from your 401k without putting yourself into long-term problems. All right. We also have another question from John.
Yep.
The other question from John is, there's an article that says modern model portfolios grow in popularity. John says, the article says there's no definition for what a model portfolio is. What is your definition? All right. A model portfolio is kind of like a spec home for a house builder. If a house builder is, there's not really a definition universal for what does a spec home look like, because it's going to be based on whatever that builder is trying to show. We is that a term?
Professionally.
Oh, okay. Professionally. I like businessly. We should add that into the dictionary at some point. We businessly, as an opinion, don't like model portfolios. because our disclosure that we gave at the beginning of the hour about investment advice needing to be specific to the people that it's being given to, a model portfolio means that we've devised a portfolio that people should fit into rather than devised a portfolio for a given person. It's a one-size-fits-all type concept.
It's a lazy shortcut.
Yeah.
In other words, there's a very popular investment advisor who advertises in the Wall Street Journal and a lot of other places. And if you have $500,000 or more, he says you should contact him. He has several model portfolios. And when you give him money to invest, it goes into one of those model portfolios, which may have 1,000 or 5,000 other people in it. In other words, the portfolio isn't designed for you. It's designed to be a fit for a given type of person.
Now, I could say that a mutual fund could be called a model portfolio.
That's true.
It's a fund that's devised. Basically, the prospectus says this is what we're trying to accomplish with the money. It's not something based on each individual investor. We're trying to accomplish this thing for this investor and this thing for that investor. Nope, that's not how it works. They say this is the purpose of the fund. A model portfolio is basically that concept without any of the, well, unless it's got mutual funds in it, without the protections of the Investment Company Act of 1940.
It's the difference between going into a store to buy a suit, although that's kind of getting a little archaic right now, or better yet, a shoe. You're buying a pair of shoes, and they say, this is the average size of a person your age and your ethnicity, and with your walking, this is the average size shoe that a person wears. So here, put it on, and that's your shoe.
Hey, that's the way they did that in the Netherlands for many years. Those wooden shoes, they basically made them one size fits all.
And it doesn't work real well for a lot of people. Now, particularly in a bull market, in the article that John sent us, his model portfolios grow in popularity. They're growing in popularity because the investment advisor that's providing the model portfolio says this is a very easy way to structure a portfolio rather than looking at the person and saying, what are your specific needs and when will you need the money and what is your risk tolerance? And designing a portfolio around you as an individual, model portfolios say, here's a model portfolio. We'll just drop you into it.
Now, let me give you another example of that, and that is a target date fund or a life cycle fund that has an age or a year associated with it. That's a model portfolio. Now, you can have a Vanguard target 2037 fund and an American Funds Target 2037 fund and Fidelity Target 2037 fund. They're going to have a different portfolio in there. There's no definition that says this year needs this portfolio. So they create a model for that year.
And there's a very serious drawback right now that's very obvious in those. There's an assumption in a model portfolio that, for instance, over a long period of time, bonds average this yield. Therefore, for the purpose of the model portfolio, they've got that yield. 60-40 portfolio with 60% of your money in the S&P 500 and 40% of your money in a long-term bond index position is a model portfolio. The problem is that the assumptions behind that model portfolio are that the average yield on that bond portfolio will be, let's say, 4%. Right now, the average yield on that bond portfolio is 0%. So what do you do with that portfolio? It suddenly becomes out of balance. As soon as you have it, it's out of balance. It has a lot of risk on the bond side and literally no reward. And so putting it in the standard 60-40 portfolio doesn't work very well, but that's a model portfolio.
Yeah. And so model portfolios are also a way that, you know, this is a good one. People ask us, what's your performance been during the downturn and the upturn? And my answer to that is always the same. Depends on the client. Depends on what they wanted, what their risk tolerance were, all of that good stuff. We don't have a model portfolio that we can have an audit on that says this is what the returns were. So that is basically what a model portfolio is. And we're about out of time for this hour. We did just get another question in from Philip And we'll get to that next hour. Thanks for the question. The question was, how can I minimize my taxes on money earned by trading stocks and ETFs that are not in a retirement account? Secondly, if I understand this correctly, I would pay taxes based on my income tax bracket, correct? And then lastly, what savings and or investment vehicle do you recommend for most, the most for minors, custodial accounts, et cetera, to have at least an amount of taxes taken from or tax-free when the child becomes of age? Go ahead.
We got it's almost the end of the hour. We need to say something.
Right. So if you want to contact us off the air, we'll be back next hour. Emails are Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. You can call our landline, which is 947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526, 914-PLAN, or the web.